Following is a presentation of Grace Covenant Baptist Church, West Monroe, Louisiana.
Adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior. So we know that Paul has been addressing various and sundry groups. He talked to older men, he talked to younger men, he talked to older women, he talked to younger women. And so now he is going to address what Titus is to teach to another group, that being slaves. Now, probably at some point in those of us who have been employed, probably at some point in your employment, the question came up, you know, as a Christian person, you know, how am I to act and react in a work situation? So these two verses were originally addressed to slaves, but we're going to transpose them and look at these principles in terms of us in a contemporary work situation. Before we do that, we do need to talk just a little bit about slaves, because the original text was written to slaves. And we need to understand the context in which it was written. In the Roman world, in the day that Paul was writing this, the Roman world was full of slaves. It's estimated that there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 million of them. Now, that's a lot of folks. And about a third of Rome's inhabitants were slaves. Again, that's another whole bunch of folks. We know that people became slaves by various and sundry ways. They were taken as prisoners of war. You could become a slave sometime as punishment for a crime. And they were taken as slaves for debts. They could be kidnapped. They could be sold into slavery by parents, which is an interesting concept. Sometimes they sold themselves into slavery. And many of them were born slaves. So if you're born a slave, you remain a slave. They had a lot of different functions. They worked as domestics. They were farm laborers, clerks, craftsmen, teachers, soldiers, managers. Some were even physicians. They could be treated harshly because Roman law did not forbid that. But many times they were trusted, they were treated kindly, and they were treated with respect. They could buy their freedom in some instances, and some were set free when their master died as a part of his last instructions. So against that backdrop, today we would look at slavery with a sense of abhorrence. It's kind of unthinkable. We would be appalled to think of people owning other people and depriving them of their freedoms. So that's kind of the backdrop against which Paul wrote to Titus about this. Now, another interesting fact. Nowhere in Scripture will you find condemnation for slavery. It does not exist. You know, no matter how hard we look for it, the condemnation of the practice of slavery itself is not there. What we do have, however, are multiple passages about how masters are to behave in relation to their slaves, and in the instance of what we're looking at this morning, how slaves are to react in response to their masters. Now, in terms of no scriptural condemnation of slavery, John Stott put it this way. He said, probably the main reason is that slavery was so deeply embedded in the structures of Greco-Roman society. To dismantle slavery all at once would have brought about the collapse of that society. And we know from other writings and other things that any any hint of a slave revolt was put down immediately and severely. So while there's no exact condemnation of the practice, we also know that Paul wrote about many of the principles that would underline the concept of slavery and ultimately led to its abolishment as a part of why it was abolished. So, in some instances, yeah. Yeah, and it depends on the philosophy that the slave owner held. I'm going with. To its principles. Yeah. And I'm going to go way out on a limb here, so just take this for what it's worth. I would suspect in the South that the slave owner had more of the concept that these are individuals made in the image of God. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate to the overseers, but I think the families probably held that basic concept. Just my opinion. So while the issue of slavery is not explicitly addressed, the responsibility of masters toward their slaves, and the slaves toward their masters is addressed in a number of places. In two letters particularly, Paul has certain things to say to Christian masters. This is Colossians 4, verse 1. Commands them to provide their slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. He writes about a similar concept in Ephesians 6. He instructs masters not to threaten your slaves, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. This is verse 9, chapter 6 of Ephesians. And there was one other cross-reference which I am not finding, so we'll move on. So we see from those passages that masters are not free to do with their slaves whatever they pleased, that they were to regulate their conduct by the fact that they themselves have a master in heaven, and to treat their slaves with fairness, justice, and kindness. So he's addressed, in these passages, he's addressed how masters are to respond to their slaves. But here in Titus, chapter 2 of Titus, we see that he's addressing how slaves are to react and interact with their masters. It's how Christian slaves are to behave in relationship to their masters or to their owners. And in these two verses, he gives us explicit directions about that. So I'm gonna take another liberty here. I'm not going to necessarily talk about slaves. I'm going to talk about employees. We're going to transpose the things Paul says about slaves or two slaves to modern employees. So,
let me ask you this question. Because I agree with you, typically, this passage and the Ephesian passage are put in modern context of work.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem like there's much talk directly of work. But surely people had standard employment as we see it today. They work, they get a wage at this time. But typically you see, marriage, family.
not sure what you're asking.
Why are there a lot more passages on slaves and masters, how to interact with each other, than there are employees and bosses? It seems like that would be just as prevalent, more prevalent than slaves and masters, yet slaves and masters gets addressed very clearly.
More than, I don't know.
And so we always take it and put it to employment, because I think it's appropriate, but we think there would also be a lot of passages talking about employment, which surely would be a common thing in their day, right?
Yeah.
How could it not be not necessary? I think where we are losing both the slave discussion and then the master discussion, as opposed to employees and employers, is in the subsistence type commerce that was occurring in antiquity versus commercialization of business today. What I mean by that is a lot of business was done in antiquity from a subsistence perspective. They were just earning money to eat. So they sold tents, they sold goods, they were silversmiths, they were woodworkers, they were carpenters, they sold honey, they did weaving, whatever. Which was kind of cottage type industry type stuff. It really was so that they could earn a living to eat, not necessarily make a profit. And we do see that changing in places like Corinth, where the middle class, with their subsistence lifestyle, changes to commercial lifestyle in the transportation of goods. And so you see a middle class growing in Corinth, where they're moving beyond just plain subsistence commerce. But for the rest of antiquity, they were basically engaged in commerce just to provide food, which is different than really how we live today. The subsistence lifestyle, although there are certain facets of our society that are going back to the subsistence lifestyle, where they basically work to provide food to eat, most of what happens in the world today is commerce. It's commercial. So it's commercial business. We are providing goods and services and whatever, not only just to provide food and sustenance for our families, but to make a profit. And where slavery, I think, really ran afoul, especially here in America, although you can make the argument for the French and the British colonies, is that slavery was more than just running a farm to grow food. It became a commercial business. And the Dutch were the ones who did that. The Dutch commercialized the slave trade as early as the 1400s. And so it was the taking of individuals from their homeland, not because they had been vanquished in battle or they were defeated by an enemy or they had sold themselves into slavery to pay a debt. You see, literally, harvesting of people for the commercial slave trade. And so the Bible clearly speaks of this. That didn't remove the humanity portion of it. But if somebody is vanquished in battle, as we saw in the conquest of the Promised Land, where people sell themselves into slavery and pay debts, then no, the Bible doesn't forbid that in certain instances, more along the vanquishing of an enemy and taking them as slaves. But, selling yourself into slavery, pay a debt, the Bible doesn't condone or forgive that at all. And so this idea of employees and employers, I don't think that you might have someone in your employ, if you were a tent maker or if you provide service, but they were really out to put food on the table. It wasn't really like trying to earn money by that, but does that make sense? So there is a difference between commerce in antiquity and commerce today, and it happens to be the commercialization of that. I know that sounds weird, commercialization of commerce, but or commercialization of business. So I think that's why you don't see a lot of discussion of employee and employer. However, I think it is valid to take the discussion of bond servants and masters into what is now commercial business, because what we see in terms of masters or the employer, what the Bible gives is extremely valid, as is the admonitions that the Bible gives to the bond servant or now the employee. Those are valid as well. And so, to answer your question directly, it's just business is different between what it was in antiquity and
Yeah, so in that frame, there would probably have been more slave-master relationships than there would have been employee-employer. However, the principles are the same, which we're going to get to in a minute. Come in.
I was just going to ask, also, when you consider those letters were written to churches dealing with character, doctrine, things like that, by instructing them in the line of what they were doing then, like Russell was going toward there too, we're giving issues of character and how these things should be taken. Because we continue to fight that fight even among what we call free men, when the serfs and such were mistreated by their royalty, in much the same way that slaves were mistreated by their owners. But there's ownership all through history. And so we were still called to exhibit Christian character in all those relationships, which would be carried over into the business parts of it, things like that.
Yeah, and we have those admonishments in all relationships. And here he's specifically focusing on slave master.
I think the translation is the modern terminology of employer and employee. Is it quite valid?
Well, sure. Sure. Now, there's one other factor that we've got to consider. Slaves typically didn't have a lot of choice about being a slave. Now, sometimes they did. I mean, sometimes they took that on voluntarily. But kind of across the board, they probably didn't have a lot of choice. On the other hand, as, quote, free people, we have the choice to be employed with a specific employer or not. That we voluntarily enter into that, if nothing else, an implied contract that thus gives the employer certain authority over us as employees. Now that's a major difference between the two groups. Nonetheless, as Paul instructs Titus to teach this group of slaves these things, I'm going to transpose that to employee employer, given all of the subsets of things that we've already talked about. So, in these two very concise, very brief verses, Paul is doing some very practical things. Remember, we talked early on about the fact that Titus is a very practical book. Paul doesn't do a lot of theology in the book of Titus. It's brief, it's concise, compared to, say, something like Romans, which is a complete, almost theological presentation. This book is very practical. So he begins to give us 5 points about how an employee is to act. Verse 9, slaves are to be subject to their masters in everything. Employees are to be subject to their employers in everything. Now note the term own. You are to be subject to your own employer. A lot of caveats to that. You're not to be subject to your peer who works for another corporation who makes the same widget you do in contradiction to what your employer wants. You are not to be subject to your supervisor who got promoted to manager who has different ideas about what the current manager wants. You are to be subject to your own employer. Now, that raises a whole other question. Who is your employer? Depending on the size of corporation you work for, you may never even see your employer. You may get a videotape from the guy at the top, quote, unquote, welcoming you to the corporation. This is our vision. This is what we're going to do to save mankind, blah, blah, blah. The next level down, senior management. You may never see senior management. These are the guys with the big offices with all the windows that are always gone for me. The next level down, the worst possible job in the world, is middle management. Now, you will probably see your middle manager, because he's the guy or gal who's always haggard, who's always on the phone, who's always got a pile of papers, because they're getting it from the top and the bottom. That's the folks that are becoming more hands-on. So you'll encounter them. And then below that, and in a lot of instances, are foremen, are supervisors, which you will certainly encounter. So these principles kind of work from the bottom up, and that's a whole other management philosophy. But the immediate application is the person who has immediate authority over us.
If you're in positions of management, if you are, you know, perhaps in Rudy's case, you know, the owner of a company, do we conduct ourselves in a way that makes it easy for our employees to be submissive to us?
Yeah, and that's a two-way thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm kind of in a spot right now where the folks that I'm supposed to be submissive to don't make it real easy to be submissive, because nine times out of ten, we don't really know what they want. So we kind of have to figure it out as we go along, only to be criticized for doing it wrong. And as a manager, that's an error. So there's kind of an implied, you know, we have to be submissive to our masters. Well, masters need to be mindful of that and facilitate whatever.
Yeah, and all of us who have worked in relatively large organizations can tell war stories about that kind of thing. I see a look of consternation. Okay. So the duty here, the focus here is one of submissiveness. We're going to come back to that explicitly in a minute. Paul writes about this also in other places. Ephesians 6, verse 5, addressed to slaves, says, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear," or with respect, "and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ." So again, we've got that Christ model for behavior. Colossians 3:22. "Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord." Peter also addresses this. 1 Peter 2:18 says, "Slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh." Which is another whole area related to those of us who have had less than desirable immediate supervisors. And that's a whole nother workshop about how you deal with that. There's some positive ways to deal with it, and there's some that are not so positive. So, anyway.
At least it is.
Didn't have that option, yes.
Yeah. So, in some ways, it's more, depending on how you look at it, slaves and masters, well, it's more difficult for them because no matter how harsh that is, that requires a step.
Yeah.
But then also, in some ways, it's easier because no matter how harsh it is, there's still not a choice. They have to say.
Yeah.
And then the employer is thinking it's easier because you can decide to leave when you want, But it's more difficult because you also have to make that decision when is that point.
Yeah.
And so,
believing within a subsistence type structure, it's hard where you may not have latitude to meet. Because you're fighting for existence, you're fighting for food.
Yeah.
And so,
or again, in a small family context, maybe, you know, if there's a brother you're working with for work
right.
for food, or a dad, you know, so they're small context.
You know, for us, if we're in the middle of a job change, there's generally shortfall in income in that job change. You know, you get started and they pay the rear or whatever. If you're in a subsistence type structure, it's not just a matter that you don't have money to go to movies. You don't have
money to eat.
So you think you may not be forced to continue in that employ, but you think long and hard about leaving that employ. Because it means food on the table.
Yeah, there's all kinds of caveats to that. If you think about the miners, and we're getting really kind of off track here, but if you think about the miners, particularly coal miners up in West Virginia, up in that area, in the earlier days, I don't know that it's true now, they were in essence owned by the company. They got their groceries, they got their coal oil, they got everything they needed from the company's store against credit for what they produced. And they never produced as much as it cost them for these things. So in a sense, they were slaves to that system. In a modern sense, and I know we're getting way far afield here, folks get into a corporation or into an organization and get vested, then you've got tremendous loss if you leave. So in a sense, they also are enslaved to that organization. So while there are some differences, there are some real similarities.
You know, the whole concept of sharecropping, where it's free. But because, like you said, everything came from that system
mm-hmm.
and was built up on a debt basis that can never be paid back.
Never paid off.
Freedom was there, but like I said, it's not what actual freedom.
While we're in this venue, I heard Henry Blackaby say one time, and I thought this was really weird till I thought about it. He said, most modern-day Christians could not leave and go do what God directed them to do because of the debt they have.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, dude, you're off base. And I got to thinking about it, and that is absolutely true. So.
And that's not just middle management. It's not just the guy down there on the bottom.
Oh, it goes all the way.
The guy comes home, and he's maxed out on his car. And
yeah.
You know, the family is going to all these different schools and things like this. And he comes home and says, I don't have a job. And they're out of their house.
Yeah. Yeah. And the solution is so simple. We were talking to somebody, and I've forgotten now who it was. Young person who has just entered the workforce. I told him, you got three basic principles. You take your first paycheck, you pay your tithe, you pay yourself, and you live on what's left. If you will do that over the course of 30, 40, 50 years, you'll have more money than you can spend. So going back to submit to employers and authority and everything, now we have to put another caveat on this everything. It's not an absolute authority. As was the case with slaves, as with employees, if the employer is instructing the employee to do something that violates God's principles, then he is not under obligation to do that. If there's no conflict between God's principles and what the employer is instructing the employee to do, then the employee is obligated to be under the authority of the employer and to do what's asked of him. So the basic problem here is human nature, human heart, call it what you want. There are few things that are more distasteful to modern man than having to submit to authority. It's just something that we don't like. But it is required. It is the duty of Christian employees. Also in verse 9, we see slaves are to try to please their masters. Employees are to try to please their employers. That is, endeavor to bring them satisfaction. Now, this is typically in our modern society, it's a matter of production. It's a matter of doing something. But it carries the sense of being conscientious, being hardworking. If an employee, I'm sure we've seen these as well, if an employee is lazy, if they don't do their work carefully, they do it half-heartedly, then he's certainly not pleasing to his both immediate supervisor and then ultimately on up the line to whatever it is the organization is trying to achieve. So God requires the same of the Christian employee that he required of the slave. That is to be conscientious, to work toward the objectives and goals that the employer sets out. Also in verse 9, slaves are not to talk back to their masters. Now this one has lots of caveats. And we're going to address this, a few of them. The sense is that the work is to be done whether or not you like the task that's assigned to you. I'm hearing chuckles. It's to be done correctly and conscientiously and whatever. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many of you have been in a situation where either yourself or someone you know has been assigned a task and it's murmur, murmur, murmur. The crowd goes murmur, murmur, murmur. It's what Asher calls the grumpy grumbles. This is water cooler talk. This is lunchroom talk. You know what that so-and-so supervisor wanted me to do. Well, Paul says that's wrong. That's a no-no. We're not to talk back in the sense we're not to grumble. Again, that's human nature. And another sidebar here. We get caught up in all these games. Well, you think that was bad? Just listen to what he told me last week. And here it goes, and here it goes, and here it goes, and it, yeah, 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 yeah. Now, first of all, that's wrong. As Paul says, that's a no-no. And secondly, it's a waste of time and energy. It takes time and it takes energy to do that, which is detracting from the task at hand. It's poisonous to an organization if it continues over long periods of time. It will, in fact, poison the organization. And that filters up. That goes up to foreman, supervisor, usually stops with middle management because he's the one that's going to take the hit. But it interferes with the organization. So, so again, that standard is no less true for Christian employees as it was for slaves. Another biggie, verse 10. Slaves are not to steal from their masters. Now, some translate it steal. I think ESV translates it pilfering. So the sense here is that they're not to steal big things. This doesn't have the sense of major corporate fraud, although certainly that's illegal and wrong. But the sense here is office supplies, paper clips, tape. If it does not belong to the employee, or if the employer has not given explicit approval to have it, don't have it. Now, again, we're going to ask for a show of hands, because I suspect we've all taken home paper clips, inadvertently perhaps, but nonetheless. We've all run a personal copy of something on the office copying machine. Sometimes we run lots of copies on the office copying machine. And not to say anything about time. How do we steal time? Another real brief war story. I did a time and motion study one time, particularly our nurses. Our nurses would come to work at 8 o'clock. They'd be there at 8 o'clock. They would not schedule a patient until 9 o'clock. At 3:30, they quit. They didn't do anything between 3:30 and 4:30, supposedly doing paperwork. Now, 8 to 9, that's an hour. 3:30 to 4:30, that's another hour. You multiply that by a month, by the number of employees, by the salary per year, and you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars that are, in essence, stolen. So it's those little things we don't think about. Overstay at a coffee break for those corporations that give you coffee breaks. Overstay in lunch. Coming in late if you don't have a time clock. Most folks now have time clocks. Leaving early if you don't have a time clock. So it's just these little nuances of how we... I thought about that this morning. I had forgotten it. You know, access to other things is so immediate and so easy. I wonder how my baseball team's doing. Let me pull up my phone and check score. You know, what, 2 minutes maybe? No big deal. Well, 2 minutes over a period of time becomes a big deal. Office computers. Many corporations now are monitoring what their employees do with them. But again, the access is so easy. Now, let me check my portfolio. Well, you know, it takes 2 minutes. Well, if the Dow is tanking, maybe I better call my financial guy. Pick up the phone, get on the phone. Depending on where he's in or not and what he's going to tell you, that's another chunk of time. Well, I mean, that's okay. I work over. Well, no, it's not okay. It's theft, basically. Also in verse 10, and we're going to hurry because we're running out of time. Also in verse 10, slaves are to be fully trusted. We've got the example of Joseph here. We all know the story of Joseph. He was in Potiphar's house, and he did so good. God blessed him. He ultimately became in charge of Potiphar's whole household, and then ultimately in charge of nearly all in Egypt. Genesis 39:6 said, with Joseph in charge, Potiphar did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. So Joseph became completely and utterly trustworthy. And Paul's exhortation here through Timothy is that Christian employees have that same kind of character. That whatever position we occupy in the organization, from janitor to chairman of the board, that we're to have that same attitude of honesty and commitment to doing our job well, to doing the best we can possibly can. So, having given us this five hows, the five things that employees are to do, he then begins to talk about the why. Beginning in verse 10, there's the so that term of conclusion, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God our Savior attractive. Now, we know in most work situations, if you're not in this situation, you have not been in this situation, you're extremely fortunate. But we know that in most situations there are other people, co-workers, supervisors, managers, that need to hear the truth about Christ. We know that. And as opportunity presents, it is also our obligation to share that. But there is also a behavioral component. That's what Paul is talking about here. That the way we behave in these five categories let me say it differently. We behave in these five categories in such a way that the gospel then becomes attractive. The flip side of that is we can behave in such a way that it detracts and the gospel becomes repugnant. You've heard this also, I'm sure. If you haven't, you're extremely fortunate. You know, if you or this other person calls himself Christian and they're doing these things, you know, I don't want any of that. So it's so that the gospel, either as we live it out or as we present it verbally, is to be attractive. So the submission, the effort to give satisfaction, the willing spirit, the honesty, the trustworthiness that's required of us certainly is not a guarantee that these other persons are going to achieve salvation. But it does set the best example we can possibly set that's in according with our professed faith. And, you know, we don't know. It may be that example that God uses to bring somebody into repentance, into regeneration. So our challenge from this passage is to behave, to work in such a way that we do not bring discredit to Christ or to his gospel. That our constant concern should be the exact opposite. Okay, let me stop with that. Thoughts, additional thoughts, questions, comments? This is one of those meat passages where the scripture meets our everyday behavior. Okay, we don't. Again, I think it would depend on the attitude of the slave owner. Now, most of these slave owners were not Christian. We have to give them that. But I think it would depend on whether the slave owner was more humanitarian or if they're completely, this is an object, this is another piece of equipment that I've got and I can do with it whatever I want. I don't know about the prevailing attitude. That's something we'd have to kind of research. Yeah. And interestingly also, God gave the slave owners in the Old Testament specific instructions about how they would treat their slaves based on that whole concept. And like the New Testament thing we just looked at, this is how you're to treat your slaves, this is how you're to treat your employees, because you're in essence one in the same with them, and we both have a higher authority that we're accountable to. You know, overall, societally, I don't know. That would be an interesting study.
One aspect of the immediate to come to mind is so many of the slaves worldwide were simply result of conquest.
Mm-hmm.
In the African kingdoms, for example, that we bought slaves from, we didn't steal from, we bought from them, they treated their slaves as a human. Everywhere they go, I mean, you go to the Aztecs, they would win the war, they sacrificed so many of their slaves and the rest of, I mean, captives, the rest of them became slaves that they sold in all over South America. So when you look at the effect of winning the war, and now they're ours, they were property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the saddest part about it in the United States is people that bought them in the North treated them as property.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers and people in the South, they treated them as property. But of the two, like you said just a while ago, the slaveholders had all depended. Some that were highly religious, that didn't know about the Old Testament, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, both taught Sunday school to their slaves. And so they would have gone through all of these different things. But some of them, unfortunately, historically, you know, did treat them as if they were just less than. We have their own records, even.
Yeah, we've got specific examples within any society, both good and bad.
Yeah.
I think the larger picture is the societal opinion, and that's the one I don't know.
Yeah, and that's right. I know the individual is comparing the number of people there,
yeah.
No matter whether you're talking first century or 19th century.
Yeah.
Like, what's the prevailing thought?
And again, I go out on a limb here. I would suspect, My hypothesis would be that the more, I'll use the term civilized, that's not exactly that I want, the more civilized the society, the greater the probability that you're going to have a more societal view of the slave as an individual. I don't know that. You're talking about the Aztecs and the Incas and all those guys. Now, they were highly technically developed, but I don't think they were all that civilized. So the hypothesis then would be that they were less likely to have a societal view of slavery compared to, say, 1700s, 1800s America. Just strictly a guess on my part.
Well, in the Roman world, it really was a function of how you came to slavery. In the Roman world, if you were a slave because of a military campaign in which you got beaten, then probably you were seen as less human than somebody who had sold themselves into slavery and paid debt. And so the offspring of those slaves carried that same stigma. Your parents were vanquished citizens of a foreign nation, your children were seen as basically property, and not so much as human beings. If you were the son or the daughter of someone who had been purchased to pay a debt and were a trusted manager, your parents were a trusted manager, then you received some of that same status within the ownership of the master within Roman culture. It really kind of depended upon where your servitude came from, which is different than what we see some of the modern expressions, even after the Incas and the Mayans and the Aztecs. Their slavery, for the most part, came from the subjugation of the other tribes in the area. So, you know, the Incas, the Mayas, and the Aztecs were all fighting amongst themselves. And so slavery came from military conquest. Don't see so much of the servitude and bondservant selling yourself into slavery so much in those cultures.
Sacrificed.
Yeah,
you
did. That's right. That's why people
didn't
do it primarily.
Yeah, yes. All other kind of the caveats. You can look at it one way, that it's better to be a slave than to be dead. Then the other way to look at that is it's better to be dead than be a slave. So, yeah, who knows? Yeah. Okay, we'll finish up chapter 2 next. No, next week we don't meet, right? Okay, we're no Sunday school next Sunday. 2 weeks we'll finish up 2, and we'll start 3, which is probably 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks, depending on how the pericopes lay out. And then we'll be done with Titus. So, all right, any other thoughts or questions? Okay.